QST, QST, QST. This is Bruce, KK5DO. And it's once again time for another edition of the Houston AmSatNet. This net meets on Tuesdays to discuss topics related to satellites, balloons, and other related items. This is net number 1673, and it's 8 p.m. Central Time on Tuesday, August 11, 2026. Which in UTC time is Wednesday, August 12th, 2026, at 0100. Sorry, this net is only being heard on Echolink and our normal streaming service, as I cannot reach the repeater from my house. URLs for this evening's net are located at amsatnet.com. Thanks, everyone, for kind of hanging in there while I wasn't around. I had the AmSat Board of Directors conferences, which are the first and third Tuesdays of the month. Sort of conflicts with the net. Then I was at a conference in Corpus Christi for a week. So things kind of get busy. So thanks, everyone, for kind of hanging in there. All right, the AmSat News Service for August 9th, which is our most current one. It's only a couple days old. And let's see, registration is open for the 44th AmSat Space Symposium. So you can go online right now, register for the event. It's going to be in Jacksonville, Florida. And the hotel has been renamed. It's now the Wyndham. And it's over there at the airport. So it's easy if you're flying in. If you're living in Florida, make a trip and visit with us. October 8th through the 11th used to be the Crown Plaza, so I guess it goes from one to another. Symposium registration is $80, and the Saturday night banquet is $60, through September 8th, after which the prices go up to $90 and $70, respectively. An all-events package combining the two is also available for $140. So, that's the early bird price. $160 is the regular price. Symposium registration includes admittance to all presentation sessions, the Friday night social and auction, the Sunday morning AmSat members breakfast, and a digital copy of the symposium proceedings. So you'll want to go get those if you are so inclined. The weekend kicks off with the AmSat Board of Directors meeting on October 8th. That's a Thursday. And we meet usually from 8 a.m. until about 5 p.m. with a break for lunch. Then it continues Friday morning until about noon. Symposium presentations begin Friday afternoon with technical sessions planned on the Gulf satellites and the CubeSat sim, as well as ARRIS updates and more, followed by the reception and auction on Friday evening. Presentations continue Saturday morning and afternoon, capped off with the annual general meeting at 3 p.m. If you participated in Field Day, that might be a nice place to visit if you want to take home your certificate if you happen to be the top winners in that event. And the evening reception and banquet, complete with ham radio door prizes. Live streaming will be available for those unable to attend in person, and a spouse program is planned. Sunday morning brings the members' breakfast, followed by optional tours of the USS Orlick, a gearing-class destroyer that served in the U.S. Navy from 1945 until 1982. And the 122-acre Jacksonville Zoo, home to more than 2,000 animals. Tour registration is an expression of interest only, with admission paid at the door, $35.95 for the zoo, and $20 for adults or $15 for seniors. AARP members and veterans aboard the Orlick. That must be the $20 and $15 thing. They kind of bled that all into one sentence there. Hotel reservations at the Wyndham Jacksonville may be made through the booking link on the symposium webpage. You can get to that at AmpsatNet.com. If you're so inclined to call, it's 800-227-6963, and our group code is AMS. So make your plans now to join fellow AmpSat members in Jacksonville, and I plan on being there as well, which means that if you have any QSL cards that you would like to get checked for LOTW, I can check your VUCC cards, your Worked All States cards, and your DXCC cards, so I can do them all for you. Even if you're not going to the conference, you can still stop by, and I will check them. So, let's see what else we've got here. Jackie Bloomer, KC9LEH. She was appointed as the ARIS Associate Director. ARIS USA is pleased to announce that Jackie, KC9LEH, has been appointed Associate Director of ARIS USA. Jackie is a nationally recognized science educator with an emphasis on space education. In her work as an educator, she has been incorporated, or she has often incorporated, amateur radio into her curriculum as a teaching tool. In addition to her many responsibilities at ARIS USA, Jackie has recently served as Business Development Coordinator and Logistics Manager for ARIS USA. In her new position as the Associate Director, her focus will be on developing relations with other space-related organizations. She will also be seeking educational opportunities to collaborate on projects in conjunction with the commercial space industry. Please join us in congratulating Jackie on her appointment and wishing her continued success in her new role with ARIS USA. Of course, that comes from ARIS USA. So, what can follow that? AMSAT CA, which is AMSAT Canada. The global radio community has expanded with the official formation of AMSAT Canada, or AMSAT-CA, making it the 28th affiliate of the Radio Amateur Satellite Corporation. AMSAT Canada joins the global network to specifically serve Canadian amateur radio operators who share an interest in space communications. More information can be found at amsat-ca.org. Building on Canada's rich history of innovation in space and radio science, AMSAT Canada stands ready to contribute to that legacy. The organization's mandate is to promote, develop, and support amateur radio in space, reflecting a long tradition of experimentation, education, and international collaboration. By uniting together, the organization aims to build a vibrant, enduring Canadian presence in space that inspires new generations, advances open science, and upholds the spirit of exploration that has always defined amateur radio. Operators and enthusiasts interested in joining the initiative, tracking upcoming projects, or learning more about membership can visit their official website, again, amsat-ca.org. All the URL links are up on amsatnet.com, just in case you're interested. And let's take a pause for the repeaters to reset. Let's see here. Okay. And looking over here on Echolink, we've got KA5YFC joining us, AD0HJ, AG9P, WD0AKO, and I think Dale makes a copy of this for us just in case we lose the audio somewhere along the line and we can get it from him. N8SGZ, WC5BYT, KC5LWY, and N6UTC, all joining us on the Echolink. Huh. Wonder why I timed out. I stopped it at 8 and a half. So maybe I got to go to 3 minutes with some of these repeaters. So I'll take a gander at that. Okay, so here's a couple stories. I guess they came from me. I'm not sure in Portuguese how they pronounce his first name, but let's go with K-L-E-I-B-E. Do the best he can. He's PP2KR, and he earned AMSAT Rover Award number 93. So he was introduced in 2018, or the award was introduced in 2018, and it recognized the operators who make grid chasing possible in the first place. The ones who pack up their stations and take them somewhere else. The award is granted to stations accumulating 25 points through roving activity, with each grid square activated outside the rover's home grid earning 1 point via a single-channel FM transponder, 2 points if you do it through a linear sideband or CW transponder, and 3 points if you do it through a digital transponder such as the ISS packet system. An additional point is added for each grid activated in a state, province, or DX entity outside the rover zone, and 5-point bonus are available both for publicizing an activation at least 24 hours in advance via a public social media post tagging at AMSAT or pound AMSAT or the AMSAT BB or this bulletin, meaning the ANS bulletins, and for posting photos of the operation afterwards. Braver souls can earn 10 points for activating a grid while operating Maritime Mobile, which also adds a Stroke MM endorsement to the certificate. Every rare grid in a chaser log is there because someone made the trip, and rover activity from South America is an especially welcome treat for satellite operators throughout the Americas. In announcing the award, Page offered his congratulations along with his customary encouragement to rovers everywhere to keep on roving. So you can get all the rules and all that good stuff up at amsat.org. Click on, I think it's satellites, and scroll down and you'll see where it says awards. Then we have Adrian, N8AGM, here in Gridmaster Award number 79. And the Gridmaster Award recognizes radio amateurs worldwide who achieve two-way communication via amateur satellite with operators in all 488 grid squares. And let me stop that. There we go. Okay, hopefully that reset the repeaters, or it didn't time me out on the repeaters. The world confirmations, wait, let me see here. Contacts must be confirmed in writing in the form of QSL cards or logbook of the world confirmations and must be made from a single location or from locations no more than 200 kilometers apart. So, lucky me, I moved from my Houston address to a address in Montgomery County. I'm even in a different county. But I'm within the 200 kilometers, so that works for my Gridmaster, should I ever get close enough to earn that. It works with my VUCC, so I didn't really have to start over. Many of the 488 grids are sparsely populated or home to no satellite operators at all. Meaning nearly every gridmaster owes a debt to the rovers who haul their stations into rare grids so others can complete the map. That makes this award a particularly fitting one. Mole is no stranger to the other side of the microphone, having appeared on the AMSAT rover pages, activating grids for fellow chasers. In announcing the award, Page offered his congratulations along with his customary encouragement to the rover community to keep on roving. And there again, if you'd like to see the Gridmaster Award and the requirements, it's all up on AMSAT.org. In fact, AMSAT.org/Gridmaster. That might make it easy too. So I actually issued number 80 yesterday. So I printed it off and mailed it. Who'd it go to? Steve K1GS. No, SG. K1SG. So he got number 80. We're getting close to 100. Someone's going to get that one. Now, NASA astronauts Jessica Meir and Anil Menon successfully wrapped up a spacewalk outside the ISS on Thursday, August 6th at 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, marking Menon's first career spacewalk and the sixth for Meir. Prior to stepping outside, the NASA astronauts completed hands-on preparations aboard the space station to ensure a smooth operation. Tool and gear configuration. The duo spent time inside the Quest airlock configuring tools and staging their spacesuits. Procedure reviews. They worked closely with fellow crew members Jack Hathaway and Sophie Adnott, who reviewed the spacewalking procedures. Hathaway and Adnott also assisted with spacesuit configurations and were assigned to monitor the extra vehicular activity from inside while helping Meir and Menon into and out of their suits. During the 6-hour, 27-minute excursion, the duo accomplished their primary objectives by preparing the station's 3B power channel. This critical maintenance lays the groundwork for the future installation of new roll-out solar arrays, which will supply additional electrical power to the orbiting laboratory. The upgraded power capacity will support vital station systems as well as future safe, controlled deorbit of the outpost. Thursday's extravehicular activity marked the 281st spacewalk conducted in support of the ISS assembly, maintenance, and upgrades. That's something that I'd like to do, is go out and do a spacewalk. Not so thrilled on the launch and the landing, but golly, that spacewalk would be kind of cool. Okay, let me pause this again for a minute. Okay. And let me get my window back. There we go. SpaceX rocket impact. The final resting place of a SpaceX Falcon 9 upper stage has been documented on the lunar surface. On the morning of Wednesday, August 5th, the 8,800-pound rocket body slammed into the moon at approximately 5,400 miles per hour. Creating a crater estimated to be about 89 feet wide. Better that it landed there than on Earth. So there's a picture of it in this story. You can sort of see it. South Korea Pathfinder lunar orbiter Denuri successfully captured images of the impact site, according to the Korea Aerospace Research Institute. The orbiter began imaging 30 minutes before the collision and performed 8 sessions as it passed over the site, securing vital before and after data. Beyond orbital imagery, scientists detected evidence of the impact from Earth. Plume detonation. Researchers at the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff reported measuring a sodium and lithium gas plume spanning several tens of kilometers, which lasted for 5 to 10 minutes following the impact. Visual confirmation. Astronauts at the Institute... this is a long one, and it's in Spain. Also captured preliminary video footage of material ejected from the lunar surface at the time of the predicted impact. The Falcon 9 upper stage had been orbiting Earth since launching the private robotic landers Blue Ghost and Resilience in January 2025. Because the stage had exhausted most of its fuel to reach a high moon-crossing orbit, it could not deorbit in Earth's atmosphere. Over time, a combination of solar activity and gravitational forces pushed the stage onto its eventual collision course. While the impact was not the intended outcome of the rocket, researchers view this as a unique opportunity to study artificial impacts. Data from Denuri will be combined with future observation from NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter to analyze the impact site. Experts hope this research will help clarify the multimodal hazards posed by space debris to future lunar infrastructure and astronauts, as well as test methods for locating seismic impact events. I've got two links up on amsatnet.com, one with the story, and it came from space.com, and another with a picture that also came from space.com. So we thank them for that information. That's pretty big news in satellite information, you know, the satellite world, because that can happen to just about all of our satellites that are launched that way, or rockets or whatever. The VUCC satellite endorsements for July were posted, actually July 1st through August 1st. And I see we've got someone new on here, W4XP. And, oh, it's not new. He had 100 before. Now he's got 126. So congratulations to him. John N7AZ keeps us up to date there. And he's also posted the DXCC standings. And let me see up here at the top, YO2CMI went from 193 to 195. I feel a little down in the dumps. So I'm down in the about 110 range. But that's the way it is. Okay. There's a few satellites added this week. CroCube got their NORAD catalog ID, as well as LASAR SAT and Marina. So they're now listed. A few schools recently completed their ARIS contacts. Geneva Christian College in Australia. Kenya Space Agency, of course, in Kenya. Upcoming, we've got the Challenger Learning Center National Conference in Massachusetts. Theirs will be tomorrow, August 12th. The Australian Air League in Adelaide, South Australia, has theirs coming up August 14th. So hopefully they all have nice and successful contacts. And let me pause this thing over here. Make those repeaters that are hooked to EchoLink happy. Okay. Clint, of course, always has something up here if you'd like to get a 75-minute presentation. I'm working EasySats. Contact Clint, K6LCSCLINT at gmail.com. And he's never given the exactly the same show twice. And the reason is he always mentions somebody that's there. And he happened to mention me when he gave our club's presentation. So he's been doing a good job on that. Scheduled events, we've got the Northeast Ham Exposition, which happens to be the New England Division ARRL Convention, August 14th through the 16th. That's up there in Boston. No, Marlborough. It's at 181 Boston Post Road. We've got a link to that on amsatnet.com. Wyoming HAMCOM, which is the ARRL Rocky Mountain Division Convention, will be August 28th through the 30th. That's going to be in Casper, Wyoming. Then, of course, we do have the 44th AMSAT Space Symposium and Annual Membership Meeting, October 8th through the 11th. And looking at satellite shorts. I love to see the shorts that these satellites wear. Don't know if, well, whatever. The European Space Agency, ESA, is hosting a global live stream for the upcoming total solar eclipse on August 12th, which will cross Greenland, Iceland, Portugal, and Spain. Hosted by science communicator Dr. Maggie Adarin Alongside ESA experts, the broadcast will air live on ESA Web TV and YouTube from 1930 to 2045 CEST. I'm not going to try to guess what time that is. Featuring telescope feeds from the observatory, up there in Spain, and live coverage of totality starting at 2031 CEST. Viewers can participate by submitting questions on Blue Sky or X using the hashtag #AskESA. ESA also reminds anyone viewing partial phases of the eclipse in person to use certified safety glasses to prevent eye damage. Just because it's on the internet and it says that it's safe, make sure you purchase it from someplace reputable. NASA has assigned astronaut Denise Burnham, AI-5RW, to her first mission to the ISS. She will serve as Expedition 76 flight engineer. She's scheduled to launch in March of 2027 from Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan aboard the Roscosmos Soyuz MS-30 spacecraft alongside cosmonauts Dmitry Petelin and Konstantin Borisov. The trio will spend approximately 7 months. Oops, I got to pause this over here again. Sorry. Okay. And we'll start back. There we go. The trio will spend 7 months aboard the orbiting laboratory conducting scientific investigations and technology demonstrations to support future exploration missions to the Moon and Mars. That comes from, where is this? That's from NASA.gov. Rocket Lab successfully launched a Japanese Earth-observing radar satellite early the morning of August 6th from New Zealand, overcoming a five-week delay following a last-second abort on June 30th, liftoff of the Electron rocket carrying the mission aptly named the Grain Goddess Provides occurred at 5:18 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. The vehicle successfully deployed the QPS SAR-13 or Mercura-1 spacecraft into an orbit 357 miles above the Earth. Operated by Tokyo-based iQPS, the satellite utilizes high-resolution synthetic aperture radar to capture day and night all-weather imagery. This mission marks the 8th of 15 dedicated launches Rocket Lab is performing to help build iQPS's planned 36-satellite constellation. Overall, it was Rocket Lab's 92nd flight and their 13th of 2026. This comes from space.com, so we thank them for that story. Astronomers have tracked a rare stellar explosion designated SN2026GZF from its initial X-ray shock breakout to its aftermath. First detected in March of 2026 by China's Einstein probe 500 million light years away, a Carnegie Mellon-led global team used a network of international telescopes to monitor the event in real time. Although the explosion closely resembled energetic supernovae, typically linked to gamma ray bursts, follow-up X-ray and radio data revealed no relativistic jets. This unexpected finding suggests the jets were choked by the star, proving that massive stars can die through a wider variety of pathways than previously understood. This comes from Carnegie Mellon University, and they're over at cmu.edu. And that does it for this week's AMSAT News Service. Vidya K4VGK was our editor this week, and she's doing a great job. She's one of the new editors at the AMSAT News Service team. So we thank her for jumping in there. And let me just take a quick look at emails, just in case there was something there. No. Okay. Yeah, my internet provider, I was getting 1 gigabit, and then I found out they've got 2 gigabit for the same price. So I gave them a little jingle, and they said, yeah, we can put you on 2 gigabit. So they did their magic. My modem did 2 gigabit. Guess what? Those 1 gigabit routers don't seem to work right. So I had to get a 2.5 gigabit router. Now that that works, I had to change out my switches to 10 gigabits. So that was fun. And then guess what? I got to put a 10 gigabit card in my computer and a 10 gigabit card in my network attached storage. And then I'll have another screaming machine. And it might be a while before I upgrade to 10 gigabits. I don't need that much bandwidth for doing nets and things like this. But it is kind of nice to back up your computer virtually instantly with 10 gigabit speed. So that's the fun in geek world. Now, I did find a neat story. Oh, gosh. Let me stop this again. I hope I'm saving the repeaters from timing out. I like this story from Space News, and it seems that this guy's got to be my favorite reporter, because every time I get a story that I like, I look at who wrote it, and it's him. So I go, So it's Jeff Faust. This was written today, August 11th, or published today, and it's a National Lab visit boosts NASA's confidence in space nuclear propulsion mission. Idaho Falls. NASA officials say they are confident in plans to launch a nuclear electric propulsion demonstration mission by the end of 2028 after visiting the National Lab building, the mission's reactor. NASA's leadership, including Administrator Jared Isaacman and Associate Administrator Amit Kastraya, visited the Idaho National Laboratory, or INL, on August 7th to review work being done on nuclear reactors there. That includes designs developed by the lab itself, as well as several companies that are using INL to test small nuclear reactors, some with potential space applications. I can see little nuclear reactors one day sitting in your backyard in a little box about the size of a shoebox, powering your house forever, and driving, powering your car, and all the satellites, and all the airplanes and jets, and all that good stuff. INL is responsible for a reactor that will be used on Space Reactor 1 Freedom, a mission NASA announced at its ignition event in March. SR-1 Freedom, slated for launch in late 2028, will use a 20-kilowatt electric nuclear reactor to power an electric propulsion system originally developed for the Lunar Gateway. That will propel the spacecraft to Mars, where it will deploy Skyfall, a set of helicopters modeled on the Ingenuity rotorcraft that accompanied the Perseverance Mars rover. SR-1 Freedom is intended to be precursor for future space nuclear power and propulsion systems, Isaacman said in remarks after the tour, drawing comparisons to the USS Nautilus, a U.S. Navy submarine that was the first nuclear-powered vessel. He said, "This is our Nautilus, and where we go from here must lead to the nuclear NASA of the future." He further said, "What should follow is an agency-wide Apollo-like endeavor, a series of SR missions progressively incorporating new technology. That would in turn lead to a vehicle capable of crewed Mars missions," he said. "Then we bring those technologies together into a vehicle capable of carrying astronauts to Mars and bring them home safely, and not just once." So that's pretty interesting and powerful if that's what they can achieve. Okay, that would, he argued, be the culmination of a third space race after the original space race of the 60s and an ongoing second space race to return humans to the moon. And we got to stop the Echo Link once more. Okay. Isaacman told reporters after his remarks that the tour absolutely increased his confidence in launching SR-1 Freedom by the end of 2028. He said, everybody's moving very quickly, including both government and commercial teams. So, SR-1 progress and challenges. NASA announced SR-1 Freedom at the same event where it also revealed its intent to establish a lunar base over the next decade. However, while NASA has provided regular updates about work related to the base, the agency has said little about SR-1 since the ignition event. As a meeting of two National Academies committees in early June, NASA officials said they were working to streamline management of SR-1 Freedom to ensure it could be ready to launch at the end of 2028, but provided few technical details on the mission and declined to offer a cost estimate. The agency later said it has a preliminary cost estimate of $2.1 billion for the mission. I wish I had a piece of that. In an interview after the INL event, Steve Sinicor, NASA's SR-1 Freedom Program Director, said the agency had recently finished a design sync review for the mission and analogous to a mission concept or systems requirements review that examined the status of major elements of the mission. Those elements include the power and propulsion element, spacecraft originally built for the Lunar Gateway with a high-power electric propulsion system. NASA plans to repurpose the PPE as the electric propulsion system for SR-1 Freedom. He said the agency was preparing a contract modification to Intuitive Machines to perform the needed modifications to the PPE. He added the agency has a concept for the spacecraft structure that will link the PPE with the Skyfall payload and the nuclear reactor. He said, quote, procurements are hitting the street for the major components, and so we're making really good progress, unquote. The heart of the SR-1 Freedom, though, is the reactor itself. The mission will use a design based on the Versatile Autonomous Lightweight Kilowatt-class reactor experiment, a reactor concept developed at INL. That reactor will use high-assay, low-enriched uranium, also provided by the Department of Energy. And there we go with 3 minutes. Okay. Neither NASA nor the DOE have provided many details about the reactor design. Media accompanying the NASA tour of INL were not allowed to take photos or videos in a room that contained information about and hardware related to Valkyrie and its application for SR-1 Freedom. And some lab officials were reticent to talk about Valkyrie. NASA officials, though, said they were pleased with what they saw of the reactor development at INL. Kishatriya, okay, well, I can butcher that name up. He said, I was super impressed to see the engineering design unit for Valkyrie. The condition that was it was in, the testing they've done. The heritage is essential to meet SR-1 Freedom schedule. We need to launch by December of 2028. And to do that, we just have to use the things that we have today, said Coleman, Division Directors for Nuclear Reactor Technology at INL. That December 2028 launch date requires the reactor itself to be completed by the spring of 2028. Who said this? I think it's still Coleman. It's a very aggressive schedule, he said, but one he felt was achievable based on what companies have demonstrated with small nuclear reactors in the past year. I think that shows it's possible and there is a supply chain that we can pull from to make that happen. The supply chain, though, poses perhaps the biggest issue to meeting that schedule. Quote, the biggest challenge is the procurement of components, said Corbisario, National Technical Director for the DOE Space Reactor Program, as those nuclear reactor startups also need some of the same components. There's some overlap with some of the components that are needed by these small commercial reactors as well. So the biggest challenge is making sure that we can get all the pieces and parts made in time to meet NASA's target, he said. Coleman, in addition to his work at INL, also serves as a senior advisor to NASA Administrator on space nuclear issues. So, and he said, in my role at NASA, I'm there to help enable that to happen, he said of SR-1 Freedom. And he further said, so if NASA's running into barriers, if they're running into issues, I'm there to help them remove those. And another little quick pause. Okay, hopefully we're keeping the repeaters happy. Both NASA and INL say they have been cooperating well on SR-1 Freedom. Corbisario described the collaboration as badgeless between the agency. You wouldn't necessarily know whether it's a NASA engineer or a DOE INL engineer. We are all part of one team, he said. It's been phenomenal to watch the nuclear reactor design engineers at INL and the NASA spaceflight engineers get together and meld their spacecraft, said Sinicor. He further said, it gives me great hope that this is going to happen and it's going to be sustainable for the future. Uh-oh, where'd that window go? Heck. I'm not sure. Hang on, I gotta find my little timer here. No idea where it went. Darn. It didn't go down into my taskbar and oh, maybe it's right here. Nope. Oh, now we're going to have to fly by to see the pants since my timer's gone. Actually, I just stopped it. Let me start it up again. That'll work. Un momento, por favor. Oh, it's running somewhere on my screen. In invisible land. I hate when things do that. Oh well. Let me get that story back. Okay. Thinking beyond SR-1. As NASA and INL race to develop a reactor for SR-1 Freedom, in time for a late 2028 launch, they say they also want to avoid developing a point design that is suitable for that mission but can't be extended to later applications such as a proposed Lunar Reactor 1 that could be used by NASA's future lunar base. All of the technology that we're using will absolutely be extensible to both Lunar Reactor 1 and the next version of SR-1, said Sinicor. He further said, that is always in our design decision. Space, is it extensible or not? Examples of this, he said, are reactors, use of Brayton power conversion systems to generate power from the reactor's heat, which can be scaled up for larger reactors, as well as heat pipe technology, he said, could be used on future reactors up to the megawatt level. Corbisierio said, I don't see any constraints in terms of scaling this up. Within the reason of the mission cases that we've thought about, this technology that we're pursuing is good. Coleman said, one goal of SR1 Freedom Program is to develop a reactor design that can then be handed over to industry to build and revise for future space missions. And finally, he said, hopefully with Space Reactor 1 Freedom, when we are done, we'll have a design that will say, yeah, that's good enough, it works, it meets the objectives. At that point, we have a technology that works, and we hope that there's a private industry out there that is interested in helping take the technology and grow it. So this comes from spacenews.com. Jeff Faust is the author. He actually has a PhD. I see here it's got his credentials at the bottom. His PhD is in planetary sciences from MIT. And he's got a bachelor's degree with honors in geophysics and planetary science. So he knows a little bit about this industry and about space. So that's cool. I think I like reading his stuff. I hope you guys enjoyed that. Let me take a quick look. I see the W5BYT repeater joined us again. I guess I keep knocking it out. Sorry about that. I'll try to find that or keep my timer on the screen next week. Stupid thing. Oh, well. Anyhow, I think I've come to the end of my portion of the net. I don't have anything else. And hope you all enjoyed it. Glad you all stuck around to listen. Those listening over on our Duck Stream, thank you for listening over there. Sorry we weren't around. The first and third Tuesdays of the month, I've got to be at the AMSAT board meeting. So I'll be missing the next week. Hopefully Marty will be back. He hurt his back while he was moving. So he's been going through some therapy and I guess strengthening those muscles and things. So hopefully he can get some antennas up and get back on the air here pretty quick. So for Marty and myself, 73, this is KK5DO.